On a patio by the water, a swing sways. Outside, a flyer sticks to a post. On it, $1 million for the safe return of Natalie Holloway. Words appear. Natalie Holloway disappeared in May of 2005.
So what happens?
The prime suspect has always been Joran van der Sloot. He has told many stories about that night, but he never admitted to murdering her. Until he went to court in 2023. Joran takes a drag from a cigarette. Peacock Original.
I'm actually with Natalie walking along the beach. We lay down together in the sand. And we start kissing each other. I start feeling her up again. She tells me no.
It's a name we hope we never have to hear again. Joran van der Sloot.
She's laying down unconscious. Possibly even dead. I decide to take her and to put her into the ocean.
That's not what happened. I'm convinced of that.
There's absolutely no reason to believe me. I would probably not believe myself, no.
This kid got away with it. So why does he kill another person when he was as free as a bird?
Joran van der Sloot, a suspect in the disappearance of Natalie Holloway, is now the number one suspect in the murder of a young woman here in Lima.
Subtitles.
We were a normal family. And this destroyed us.
He shows absolutely no remorse. He shows such a lack of concern. But if you don't think that this story could get any darker, stand by because it does.
A surprising development and a mystery going back almost 20 years.
Van der Sloot is accused of offering to tell Natalie's family where she was buried in exchange for $250,000.
To come up with this master plan of extorting the grieving mother, it's so far beyond what you would expect even a psychopathic killer to do.
18 years later, my mom is standing in the courthouse within feet of the guy that killed my sister.
He has single-handedly destroyed everyone around him just for his own selfish existence on this earth.
It's just important for everyone to know the truth.
He's incapable of telling the truth. He's a pathological liar.
Pathological. The lies of Joran van der Sloot. Subtitles. Ava, weren't you afraid of starting a relationship with a prisoner? Ava Pacowanaco, Joran's girlfriend. Joran appeared in my life at a chaotic time. My son's father had abandoned me. I was devastated. Joran was a refuge for me. Going into the prison, I felt calm, loved. He made me feel very special. He wrote letters for me, too. He wrote with stars and hearts. He's very romantic. What I treasure the most is this small keychain. It says here, Joran. And on the back, it says, Ava, with a heart on the J. I have an immense affection for Joran. But it would have been better not to have met him. Ava wipes her nose and eyes with a tissue. On a map, Aruba, 05-30-2005.
First, a very serious story. A high school senior from Alabama is missing today. She disappeared during a trip to Aruba. She was there celebrating her graduation.
Nicknamed Hootie, Natalie went to Aruba on a senior trip.
This story just broke across the wires today. We're going to be following up on it tomorrow.
Jessica Cayola, high school classmate.
I remember sitting on the bus and one of our chaperones saying, you know, has anyone seen Natalie? Everyone is here except for Natalie. And so at first, we were like, she must have, like, be sleeping through her alarm. But then very, very quickly, it took a pretty scary turn. She wasn't in her room. She wasn't on the beach. We collectively started trying to understand, like, who saw her last and who was she with. A lot of us were not prepared to leave without her. We were all just devastated. Just devastated. This is what our parents had always told us to be careful of.
Michelle Kaczynski, NBC News correspondent.
Natalie's the good girl from a good family, straight A student. She's about to go off to college.
All right. Yes. Who's our special guest today?
It's Hootie.
Hootie Hoo Holloway.
Hi, friend. Just, you know, sitting in the back, cruising over to my place.
We called her Hootie.
Claire Fearman.
And she was hilarious.
There's Hootie.
If she liked or didn't like something, you knew.
Friend of Natalie Holloway.
A fearless friend, so completely herself. It's like so silly, so fun, so smart.
She had a full scholarship to the University of Alabama. Her plan was to do pre-med.
Matt Holloway.
She earned that. She worked so hard.
Brother of Natalie Holloway.
I have no doubt that she would be the best physician out there.
How could this happen? When you were watching this, you just wanted the worst case scenario not to be true.
She's approximately 5'5". She weighs about 110 pounds.
Beth Holloway is absolutely convinced that something has happened. She's desperate to find Natalie. And she actually arranges to be flown down to the island.
Lisa Pulitzer, co-author, Portrait of a Monster.
By the time we were home, Beth was in Aruba. We all gathered at my house, just trying to rack our brains, relay any information that we possibly can back to Beth.
From above, the sun shines on a roundabout.
Within hours, we had realized who Yoron was. One friend could describe him, and she could name him.
Beth goes to the Holiday Inn where Natalie had been staying.
Beth walks through the hotel.
And at the desk is a woman who remembers Natalie. And when Beth says the name Yoron, she knows exactly who he is. He's here often.
She said, oh, that's Jeroen Vandersloot. He likes to prey upon young female tourists. When I heard that, I was like, oh, my gosh. Oh, dear God, you know, he got one, you know.
Lima, Peru, 05/30/2010. Exactly 5 years later.
The hours were passing, and we didn't hear from Stephanie. It was around 12:30 or 1 a.m.
Ricardo Flores, father of Stephanie Flores.
We were getting worried, more distressed. We were never out of touch for more than 2 or 3 hours. She was my only daughter. She was always by my side. Always, always. Even when we were racing cars, she drove with me several times. She was the one who pushed me. She was my co-pilot. But I didn't see her that last day.
Enrique Flores, brother of Stephanie Flores.
She didn't answer her phone, so it was not normal. My dad got worried, and he started to call all her friends. Then we find out that the last place that they saw her was entering to the casino.
Atlantic City Casino, Lima, Peru.
Stephanie was good at mathematics.
A slot machine plays.
And she played poker. The unfortunate thing was that she would win. So damn, there was no way to punish her. But we didn't think it would lead to what it did.
Cole Thompson, co-author, Portrait of a Monster.
The family approached the owner of the casino. They bring the Flores family into the back room, and they start matching up the cameras.
Lights reflect off a camera.
They find Stephanie. They see the guy standing next to her. You see them on the casino floor. They're gambling together, and this is camera after camera, just one angle cutting to the next. You can trace their movements through the casino until they walk out of the casino into the dark together. So at that point, they have a face. They don't have a name yet, but Joran had registered for a prize at the casino. So when he registered for that, he put down his name. So all of a sudden, they have a name, they have a face, punch it into the internet. Oh my God.
My daughter-in-law went up to the second floor of the house we lived in and searched the internet. My daughter-in-law shouted. She shouted for us to come up to the second floor.
And at that moment, we find out who he was.
They're frantic. There's just howls and shrieking, and they know that their daughter's probably dead.
We bring our children into the world to love them, and because of one small error, we lose them.
Ricardo covers his face. He walks off. Clouds hang over the ocean. Aruba, 05/30/2005.
It was Natalie who asked me to go out with her. It was her that asked me to come to the club. It was her that was yelling at me to go dance with her.
Psychiatrists aren't allowed to diagnose public figures without having personally assessed them. That said, everything I've read about him is consistent with what you would see if you were psychopathic. Externalizing blame is a real hallmark of psychopathy, where everything is somebody else's fault. It's never your fault. You can always come up with a reason that somebody else is really to blame.
She came to me. She was the one that talked to me. And she wanted to come with us. And it was probably a bad choice. We probably should have told her she had to get out of the car. You never know what would have happened.
The teenager was last seen leaving this establishment on Monday morning at 1:30.
On a red neon sign, Carlos and Charlie's.
That night, Natalie was one of my buddies.
People stand on stage.
A lot of us are up on the bar, dancing and talking, and I snapped a photo. And you can see Natalie talking to one of our friends. And we were just having a great time. But when we were all ready to go home, we were starving, and we were at the food truck right outside Carlos and Charlie's. And this is when I saw Natalie in a car. The car was silver, and she was in the back seat. I can see her waving to us. I see it so vividly. She was really happy. She was laughing and singing and waving to us. And so we literally were like, oh, how funny. There goes Natalie. I guess she got a ride home. And that was the last time we saw her.
From above, umbrellas line a beach. The next day, 05/31/2005.
Her parents showed up at my door with her picture. I didn't even know who Natalie Holloway was. I didn't even know her name.
Beth is really anxious. She's very worried about her daughter. Now she has a name. She's able to get an address. And she goes back to the police station because she wants help.
Charles Crows.
I knew a lot of the police guys. On a small island, we grew up together. I spoke English like an American, and I looked more American than some of the other people trying to help. So I said, I'd be glad to help in any way I could.
Local liaison for Beth Holloway.
Beth was very grieving and very frustrated, but she was definitely on a mission. I asked the police, do you know where the guy lives? And then she said, yeah, yeah. So we went and we drove around the house.
Nighttime. A car passes a gate.
I saw the silver car, so I felt settled in that we were at the right place.
Police knock on the door. Jeroen Vandersloot's father, Paulus, answers the door.
Then the father said to Jeroen, tell him what you know. And Jeroen said, no, I don't know anything about her. I don't know who it is. I did meet her. We went out and had some drinks. But no, that's as far as it goes. And I said, you better tell the truth. Whatever it is, if you did nothing, say that. Don't lie, because you're going to get in a lot of trouble. And then he said, we took her to the Holiday Inn. And at the Holiday Inn, she got out and she tripped. When she tripped, she banged her head, then went into the Holiday Inn, but never came back, and they left. The feeling I got was that he wasn't solid, you know? It's just a feeling that you get from people when they're not solid about what they're saying. I didn't know if he was guilty, but I did feel that he wasn't innocent. And at that point, Father looked at the crowd and he said, that's it.
Steph Watts, investigative journalist.
Jeroen Vandersloot's family was very influential on the island. His mother was well-known and well-liked. She was a school teacher. His father was a prominent lawyer up for a judgeship.
Jeroen had moved to Aruba when he was a young boy, but he'd been born back in the Netherlands, and the father wanted to work his way up in the legal ranks, and maybe going to a far-flung outpost was a way for him to get a judgeship. So the family wound up in this island paradise. For a teenage boy, there was a lot to do. He had kind of the run of the island, and he had a mean streak.
I mean, we had heard that he had anger issues. We would hear that from former girlfriends or people who knew the family.
There had been reports of his abuse of animals. He had thrown a homeless man off of a bridge, much to his amusement.
There were reports from women on the island that he had harassed or sexually pressured young girls. One of the girls was as young as 12.
A photo of Jeroen with two girls.
But the problem was any of the women who had come forward were so frightened by this media that was now on the island that we really were never able to get a full picture of what exactly had transpired. Jeroen was creating some tension in the home as well. He had two younger brothers and was bullying one in particular.
And at that point, the family said, okay, this has gone on too far.
Abigail Marsh, psychologist.
Deliberately harming an innocent victim just for the fun of it, stealing, lying. When you start seeing not just one kind of antisocial behavior, but a whole range of them, that's when you start suspecting a kid has a real disorder of aggression. These are children who are at risk of becoming psychopathic as adults.
His mother, Anita, did seek help and did have Jeroen speak with a therapist on the island. And at one point, Jeroen was moved from the house and into this guest cottage where he could be on his own, and there was a physical separation between the brothers.
And that gave him the ability to just come and go as he pleased. So he looked older for his age. He could go into casinos, gamble. You could get free drinks while you're gambling. It was perfect. And nobody questioned him.
Abigail Vandersloot, Joran's mother.
Joran is a teenager, 7-year-old teenager, like every other boy. He's a very honest boy. He's very sincere. Why would a boy who has enough friends, who has a normal life going on, why would a boy do something wrong to a girl he just met?
The truth will come out. And when I look at this boy, I only can say he's telling the truth.
Lima, Peru, 05-31-2010. 2 days since Stephanie disappeared.
When my daughter started college, I gave her an SUV and her own credit card. That freedom my daughter had with money and comforts, it was bad. Because I didn't teach my daughter that there was also evil in the world.
Next day, the police found her vehicle in an alley.
My daughter would never separate from her car for any reason. She loved her car very much. We rushed over. It was a horrible place. It was a place where people did drugs. And later, when the Jeep's interior was all messed up.
Captain Juan Cayan, Peruvian National Police, retired.
It looked like everything had been rummaged through. There were the victim's clothes, personal things, and the fingerprints also concluded that the Dutchman, Joran, had been inside the vehicle. That is why the arrest of the foreign citizen was requested in less than 24 hours.
Ica, Peru, 180 miles south.
My name is John Williams Apracana Piscante. I'm from Ica. I transport passengers. I work as a cab driver. That day, back in 2010, Mr. Joran arrived to where I was working. He was there to keep traveling south. He told me, "Let's go, because my friends went ahead of me, and I have to catch up."
Williams drives a car.
He had changed his appearance by the time he got into the car. He'd shaved his hair somewhat. He had dyed it. He had changed his clothes. He knew that everyone was looking for him at that point.
The drive between Ica and Nazca is about two and a half hours. Mr. Joran only smoked cigarettes. I'd describe his behavior as normal, just like any other passenger.
William's reflection shows through a rearview mirror. Aruba, 06-04-2005. 6 days since Natalie disappeared.
As you know, our primary goal is to bring Natalie back home. We will do whatever it takes. There is a significant reward for the person who returns Natalie to us safely. Please help bring her home.
The disappearance of Natalie Holloway topped the ratings over the Iraq War. I mean, the fascination with the story was like nothing we'd ever seen, you know, since OJ.
Can you give us a statement? Talk to us!
It was the perfect storm.
Well, let's go to Michelle Kaczynski for the very latest. Michelle, what's been going on today?
Today was really about emotion. First, we saw Natalie Holloway's mother, Beth, go...
There's so many aspects to it that grip people's attention. There's the mystery of it. There's the sympathetic fear of, I'm a parent, I send my kids away to camp or whatever. And you tell yourself, oh, what are the odds? And then something happens like this on this level. You can't stop watching. And you want everything to be okay, but you kind of know it isn't. And then you want to know who did it and why.
We have no information, no clothing, no footmarks, no blood, nothing to go off of to be able to dictate what happened to this literal angel.
Dave Holloway, father of Natalie Holloway.
They can find the haystack, we can find the needle. So, but the problem is, where's the haystack?
Benvita D'Souza, former attorney for Beth and Dave Holloway.
The FBI was here. Search dogs were here. The Dutch army even flew over Aruba with special airplanes that could detect heat.
Summer 2005 was a complete roller coaster with media because it would be, this person has this lead.
The security camera at a gas station reportedly caught an image of what someone thought was Natalie Holloway.
Then it was big hopes, super exciting. In my mind, I was like, oh my gosh, we could talk to her tomorrow.
We know that she's on the island. We really feel strong that she's being kept against her will.
You know, and it was so thrilling and so exciting.
It turned out those blonde hairs that were found on duct tape a few weeks ago were not Natalie's.
Crash. Nothing.
Dave walks through a bush.
I had that gut feeling that, yes, as a parent, you just have that feeling that she's not here anymore. But on the other hand, I had to convince everybody else that I had the wrong feelings, that maybe we would find her alive or whatever. But I had that sinking feeling that things aren't right.
I remember my dad jumping down into a landfill and just physically ripping open trash bags, garbage bags, moving large appliances, picking up stuff with his bare hands and just searching for Natalie's body. My dad was in that 100%, and seeing that was really powerful.
Beth and Dave hang their heads.
There's a lot of times over the years where sunglasses were my best friend. And, you know, to hide the tears that were running down your face. So I started having panic attacks. And the attacks became so bad, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. Sometimes you lose it and you start just digging in a sand dune or let's look in this hole, you know, knowing that there's nothing there, you know, but let's do it.
It's just really hard to be around that kind of loss and emotion, like that kind of loss. It's so awful. It's so deep. And you're around it day after day, you know?
Authorities continue to question three men Holloway was last seen with.
Dutch teen Doron Vandersloot and Surinamese brothers Deepak and Satish Kalpo. All three men apparently acknowledge giving her a ride back to her hotel the night of her disappearance.
They had interviewed the three suspects, and they said the route they took was around the lighthouse, and then they came back and dropped her off in the lobby of the Holiday Inn. The surveillance footage of the Holiday Inn was viewed, and we found out that she did not return to the hotel.
There is absolutely no footage of her anywhere outside of the hotel. There's no car dropping her off. And at this point, Joran Vandersloot's story begins to change. So now that he claims that he took Natalie to the beach and that he left Natalie at the beach.
I thought maybe she'd understand. She told me no, she wanted me to stay there with her because the next day she was leaving and she wanted to stay there the whole night. I told her no, I had to go. I even lifted her up to carry her back to her hotel. And she told me to put her down.
And he claims that he called one of the Kalpo brothers, Deepak, to come and pick him up and that he went home. But
city lights shine by the beach.
Police had gone back and they were able to discover that, in fact, Deepak was home that night on his computer. And at some time after 3 a.m., Joran had sent him a message saying, I'm home.
His story was unraveling. As pieces of evidence came in that worked against him, he would sort of switch his story.
I would love for someone to come and tell me if there's anything worse I did, because I've never touched a girl in an aggressive way in my life.
Truly pathological liars, that's exactly how they lie. When the lie is disproven, you turn around and tell another lie without even stopping to catch your breath. That's true pathological lying.
How did you feel when you left her?
Well, at the time, I didn't feel it was a bad idea. At the time, I really didn't.
You know, like you don't care about the truth. I think in one of the early pictures I saw of him, he had a little bit of a smirk on his face, which I remember thinking was a little bit surprising for somebody who was being, you know, falsely accused of a terrible crime you didn't commit.
What was the last thing that she said to you?
She didn't say any last thing to me. The last thing I said to her was bye.
He came across as cocky and not caring. It didn't faze him at all. I think Euron felt untouchable because of his father's status on the island.
How's he doing?
Paulus has a very close relationship to the chief of police, Vanderstraaten. They know each other from the Netherlands, and there was speculation that Chief Vanderstraaten is Euron Vandersloot's godfather.
This is my name, Mr. Commissioner Vanderstraaten.
And at some point we learn that a meeting has taken place at the Vandersloot home between Paulus Vandersloot, his son Euron, and the two Calpo brothers.
The prosecutor's office let us know that Euron Vandersloot's father allegedly told all three of the boys that without a body, there is no case.
It is believed that Paulus was counseling the three of them to not say anything, not speak to police. Because if there is no body, there's no crime. At that point, suspicion starts to really move to Euron's father, Paulus.
Is there anything you'd like to say?
What does he know? What is he counseling his son? Are they trying to get their story straight? There's a belief that perhaps Paulus was directly involved in whatever it was that happened to Natalie's body after she died.
Cameramen follow Paulus. Aruba, 06-09-2005, 11 days since Natalie disappeared.
11 days after Natalie disappeared, police arrested Euron. The very day he was supposed to have graduated from high school.
Finally, Euron Vandersloot is arrested under suspicion of murder.
There's a lot of questions about why now. Authorities are saying that they are doing everything methodically, carefully, and by the book.
There was no real piece of evidence linking him to Natalie's disappearance. But unlike our system, where you need to have evidence in the Dutch system, you are able to hold somebody under suspicion.
It's called a preventive detention. And during that period is when the investigation goes deeper.
With no real evidence to further this case, police were really looking at ways to try and get him to speak. And they did countless interviews with him. These were intense, multi-hour interrogations.
The interrogations, of course, were horrible because they put stuff in your head. They really try and make you look guilty, even if you're not guilty.
No matter who was interviewing Euron, he would tell a story and it would feel as though he was getting to the point where he was going to perhaps confess. And then he would always pull back and the story would go off on a tangent and there would be details that would come in that were not there before. And all of a sudden, he's pointing the finger at the Calpo brothers.
Officers guide the Calpo brothers outside.
That they knew that he had gone home, that he had left Natalie at the beach. And perhaps one of them went back to the beach and he killed Natalie.
He's just dancing circles around the investigators. He seemed to be enjoying himself. He knew there was nobody to find. His father had told him, nobody, no crime.
How you doing, Yarn?
And he never once admitted to this crime. And so people on the island would say, well, you know, he was interrogated. He didn't admit it. Maybe he didn't do it. Or maybe he's a sociopath.
Euron sits in the back of a car. Aruba, 09-03-2005. 3 months since Natalie disappeared. Outside a prison, Euron's parents get out of a car. Cameramen gather behind a barrier.
Euron Vandersloot, jailed since June 7th. Now a free man. He returned home to cheers from friends and family.
If they suspect that you're a part of a crime, it's up to the prosecutor to gather additional information. If they don't, then they're set free. And no new evidence was presented.
So on September the 3rd, 2005, they let him go.
Yarn was the last person seen with my daughter. He knows what happened, and now he's free and clear.
Yaron looked at a very bright future, just graduated, accepted at a lot of universities, and was ready to go to Tampa to study. His life has been turned upside down completely. I hope that everyone gives Yaron a chance to continue his life.
For lying, I probably deserved to be in that jail for 3 months, but I didn't do anything against the law, and they have to let you go. They have to let me get on with my life.
Yaron walks to his house.
I want to thank everyone for coming.
The day that Yaron was released from prison was a real turning point. You know, for Beth, for Dave, for anybody who was hoping for any kind of justice for Natalie. What it was basically telegraphing to everybody was, he got away with this.
For the rest of my life, I will continue to be the voice for my daughter seeking justice in Aruba. Every parent would want the same justice for their child. And thank you.
Really, we didn't think there was a chance in hell that Yaron would get out. Absolutely not. Yaron is a time bomb waiting to go off. And it truly concerns me that another young female would fall victim to this. So I think the safest place for Yaron to be and for his potential victims to be would be for him to be behind bars. He does not need to have another young female fall victim to his actions.
Lima, Peru, 05/31/2010, 2 days since Stephanie disappeared.
Stephanie studied business administration at the University of Lima. Her truck was found in the Jorge Chavez alleyway. We divided Lima. One group went on one side, another went on the other.
From above, cars move on a lit city street.
The Flores family is becoming more and more desperate. They've got the news of who this kid is. The more and more time slips away, something terrible has happened. They know it in their hearts.
We went to all the casinos. We made an action plan to look for her at all the hotels. There wasn't a single place we didn't check. We did everything a family could do. Everything. Everything.
Nazca, Peru, the same night.
We arrived at Nazca at 12 or 12:30 a.m. And he said, can you take me further south? My friends are ahead of me, and time is of the essence. It is a dangerous road. And because my car is very small, I said, I can't keep advancing. But my brother is coming behind me, and he has a bigger car. Ask him how much he would charge to take you.
A man joins Williams. Oswaldo Apricana, taxi driver.
I told him I could take him to Tacna. I priced the ride as $1,500. It's a 15-hour trip. We always take two drivers on long trips like this. I told my brother to come with me and I would pay him. He told us he had the money.
A white van drives on a well-lit street.
He seemed calm. He talked about his family in Aruba. He said he had some issues with someone in Peru. We went on asking about these problems, and he changed the subject. He said, it's nothing, it's nothing.
Williams frowns. The van drives on an empty street. Lima, Peru, 06-01-2010, 3 days since Stephanie disappeared. Adeli Abad Marchena, night clerk, Hotel Talk, 2010-2017. I worked as a night clerk at the Hotel Talk. Mr. Yoran, if I'm not mistaken, stayed for 13 or 14 days. On Sunday morning, at around 5:30 or 6 a.m., he arrived with a girl. The girl walked behind him and they went up to his room. On security cam footage, Yoran and a girl enter his room. Daytime, outside. Birds fly to and from a church. The sky darkens over the city. On Tuesday night, I went to work. It seems strange to me because his room payment was overdue by 2 days. He had never been late. He was always on time with the payments. So then I called his room. In a hotel room, a phone sits on a nightstand. Nobody in the room answered. So I went up to the room and I knocked on the door. I could hear something was on inside, some noise. I opened the door. When you enter the room, there is a hallway. From the hallway, the bathroom is on the right. You enter and there's the main room. The TV was turned on. I went further in. Between the bed and the wall, there was a body lying on the floor. The Netherlands, 09-06-2005. 3 months since Natalie disappeared.
One of the suspects in Natalie Holloway's disappearance left Aruba Monday. Joran Vandersloot left to attend college in the Netherlands.
Joran was supposed to go to the United States. He had a scholarship to a college in Florida, and he was going to play tennis. He was a fabulous tennis player in Aruba. And so all of a sudden, his whole life also is upended.
It seems that Joran Vandersloot chose to have a cold Christmas this year.
His parents send him back to the Netherlands, where he enrolls in school there. And the media, intense media, is still following him.
I can't even walk around in the Netherlands because almost half the people there think I'm a murderer.
In a sort of weird way, he liked the attention he was getting.
Did you kill Natalie Holloway?
No.
Everybody was talking about this case. It went international. And I think that he would say anything just to keep the limelight on himself.
Joran Vandersloot quickly figured out how to manipulate the media. I think out of the gate, he realized he could use this to his advantage. It was almost a cat and mouse game with him and the media. But as we know, that game became very, very dangerous later on.
The Netherlands, 02-2008, nearly 3 years since Natalie disappeared.
Now for more on what could be a major development in the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. This Dutch reporter claims that he has solved the Natalie Holloway case, that he has a confession on tape.
We did a hidden camera operation.
Peter de Vries was a Dutch journalist, and obviously he was hot on this story.
And he is going to make it his mission to get Joran to confess. Peter de Vries connects with a gentleman named Patrick Vandereem. And Patrick has befriended Joran, and he's convinced that he can get Joran to confess. And so they end up concocting a situation in which Joran is in a car that they have rigged with cameras and audio.
And yeah.
Shit, man. She didn't look good. She looked pale, but she was in the mood. She really wanted it.
Water crashes onto a shore.
And all of a sudden, Patrick, she was doing things, just like in the movies. Was she shaking? Yes, a lot. So I thought, shit, what is all this?
In this particular version of events, he was with Natalie at the beach, and she began convulsing. And she fell unconscious. He believed that she was dead. And he called a friend who came with a boat.
He went far, and he just threw her into the sea. Patrick, I didn't feel bad about it at all. I didn't lose a single night's sleep over it.
We all gathered at a friend's house, had this big screen that we were going to watch it on. It was wild to watch. In that interview, he said Natalie's dead. So that was the first time that I had really, like, heard that out loud. I need to start to come to terms with that.
I wanted to come through the TV and kill him. I wanted to peel his skin off his face.
I mean, it was like, how could somebody be so cruel and inhumane? I was shell-shocked. It was a good thing there was an ocean between us and Holly, because I would have come after him.
He shows absolutely no remorse. He shows such a lack of concern. At this point, we're seeing how dark of a young man Jeroen van der Sloot was becoming.
And in my mind, case closed. That was that. We got the information.
The authorities looked into it.
Jeroen sits in an interrogation room.
Jeroen van der Sloot was questioned by a Reuben and Dutch police on Friday. It happened less than a week after a Dutch TV program aired a hidden camera interview with van der Sloot, saying he was with the missing Alabama teen when she died. During his questioning, van der Sloot insisted he was under the influence of marijuana during the interview and denied any role in Holloway's disappearance.
Let me begin by saying that I have a great imagination. I just knew that this is what he wanted, to hear a story like that. This is a story I chose to tell him, but which is absolutely not based on truth.
Even if a person confesses to a crime, you need extra evidence in order to charge.
And let me express myself clearly now. You are not telling the whole truth. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, we're done here.
He was very cocky during the interrogations.
No, listen, listen. I don't want to listen. I'm also fed up. I don't have to listen to this.
But I do think that he knew that they wouldn't be able to frame anything on him.
Bring on your so-called proof. You haven't got any. I know it's not true. So what can you do?
Why? Because somebody helped him. Somebody very close to him. Very, very close to him. Nobody else would take that risk.
Thailand, 07-2008.
Tonight, the incredible new twist in the Natalie Holloway investigation. Jeroen van der Sloot goes on the record with a shocking talk of what he says happened to Natalie Holloway the night she disappeared from Aruba.
In 2008, I had a meeting with Greta Van Susteren, my boss, and she said she had received an email from Jeroen, and I was to fly to Thailand and meet with him. At this point, his life was in turmoil. He was a gambling addict, and he was desperate for money. He had a friend in Thailand, and he ended up in Thailand. My assignment was to track him down and secure an interview. But the conditions of that were we were going to pay him $25,000 to tell us what happened to Natalie Holloway. I knew he wanted the money, but here was the problem. Going to Thailand and giving somebody $25,000 is incredibly problematic. There's a rule that you can only legally take $5,000 with you into the country. The rest of the money had to come in $5,000 wire transfers. There's a time difference, and we can only do $5,000 in a 24-hour time period. He was desperate, and he wanted that money, and he was growing increasingly impatient. So in that time period, I had to entertain him. Being with Jeroen van der Sloot, he's incredibly charming. I had to constantly remind myself of why I was there and who he was. He was cordial, he was funny, but I realized how incredibly dangerous of a situation I was in. He could have snapped on me. I saw that in the hotel room. He's incredibly agitated. At one point, he asked me to go get the money out of my own personal account because he couldn't wait any longer. So Greta arrives, and we had no time to waste. He's agitated and wants to get this interview over because he knows the faster the interview's over, the faster he's going to get the payment.
You met a guy in February of 3 years ago who said he was interested in something. What was he interested in?
As the story unfolds, he tells a tale.
He was interested in me bringing him a blonde girl.
He had been in contact with a guy from Venezuela, met him at a casino, and the guy said that, you know, he would pay money for American girls, particularly blonde girls.
And then he said to meet him at the beach by the Marriott if I ever got a girl, and that he would give me $10,000. The day I met Natalie, I remembered what he said.
In the moment as the story's unfolding, it's feasible. We all know human trafficking is a huge problem. So I'm putting the pieces together in my head that this is a possibility. But what happens next astounded all of us. After the interview, we're on our way to the airport, and Greta receives a text that says, "Everything I told you was a lie. I just did it for the money." Greta looks at me and says, "What do you think?" And I said, "I think he's telling the truth here for the first time."
We still do not know which version, if any, is the truth.
We made the decision to air the Yaron Vandersloot interview, disclosing that we had paid him the money. And I think in our minds, that was our way of getting back at him and showing the world how dark he had become and how he now had perfected using the disappearance of Natalie Holloway to make himself money to finance his desperate gambling addiction.
Aruba, 2010.
A potentially key witness in the disappearance of American teen Natalie Holloway has died. Paul Vandersloot collapsed playing tennis.
Yaron gets a phone call from his mother alerting him that his father had a heart attack and he died. There was a lot of speculation that the intense pressure and scrutiny under which his son had put him is what really led to him having this heart attack.
Yaron literally throws himself on the casket and says, "This is all my fault. I did this to you." Makes a big scene. Whether it was an act or whether it was sincere, only Yaron can answer that question. But he was visibly broken by the death of his father.
I don't know if a person like Yaron Vandersloot has any kind of remorse, but what we do know was that his dad was his rock for a long time, to the point that lots of people believe that his dad helped him cover up the body of a young woman so that it was never seen again. Whether his father helped him out that night or not, he had to have known that his father was always going to support him. And then that one person was suddenly gone.
So he comes back to Aruba, and he moves back in with his mother. And it's my belief that losing his father really marked another turning point for Yaron.
If you don't think that this story could get any darker, stand by, because it does. When he flies back to Aruba, you would expect someone to be mourning the loss of a parent, assisting his mom. Instead, Yaron Vandersloot is doing the most horrific, heinous thing that you could possibly imagine.
He allegedly contacted Natalie's mother in Alabama and offered to tell her what happened to her daughter, including where her remains are, in exchange for $250,000.
John Q. Kelly, attorney for Beth Holloway.
He contacted me. "Hi, John, this is Yaron." Quickly got to the point about, you know, he wants to clear his soul, clear his conscience, and really tell what happened to Natalie and stop the Holloway grief and things like that. But in exchange, he would like $250,000.
Aisha Ashai, psychiatrist.
The lack of emotions that he has when he is
reaching out to Beth Holloway to get money from her, knowing that this woman lost her child. He doesn't care. There's no registration of empathy. And that's characteristic psychopath right there.
So I said, let me talk to Beth. I said, I've got an idea, Beth. I think I can do something. If he takes money, that's extortion. If we can set up where he wires part of it, that's wire fraud. We could, you know, get him on both those counts, U.S. charges, and, you know, lock this guy up. I called the FBI right away. I said, let's do this. Can we do this? You're almost like, let's meet Aruba. You can bring the first 25,000 with you, and I'll give you all the information. Went down there, met with him. You could tell all he wanted to do was get right to the point. Like, did you bring money? I said, yes, I did, Your Honor. I could only bring 10,000 in cash. So I'm gonna give you 10,000 and have 15,000 wired by Beth. We got in the car the FBI had provided me. It was all rigged up with video cameras and audio cameras. He pointed to one house, said, this is the house. That's where you're saying Natalie's remains are. He said, yes, definitely. My father brought me here one day and showed me this location. He told me that he had gone home and told his father what happened. And he had driven back with his father and pointed out where Natalie was. Paulus had told Euron to wait in the car. And Euron understood that his dad had gone down, pulled Natalie further into the brush, and covered her with a couple pieces of large cardboard and left her there. And then he said, I don't know if my dad came back the next night or two nights later, got her body and disposed of it then. I thought it was all bullshit right from the start. Because his dad was dead. Euron loves giving information that can't be verified, you know, so. This was just one more, you know, spoke in the wheel of lies of his. The FBI had told me they knew it was a hoax because they had satellite photos of the area where the house was, showing that it was still undeveloped land at that point in 2005. That was that. And I went back to the hotel. FBI guys were all ecstatic. And I said, great job. We've got it all on videotape. We've got it all on audio tape. And nothing happened. I don't know why they didn't pick him up. I was like, guys, you got the whole thing videotaped and audio taped. What are you doing? And I start getting emails from Euron. You seem like a really nice man, Mr. Kelly, but I'm sorry I did this to you. I lied about the whole thing. You know, thank you for the money. It's all about money.
Poker chips and cards flash.
Now he is spending all of his time at the casino. You know, he's really heavily into gambling. His mood is very dark. Anita is very concerned. And she's convinced that it is because he's just lost his father. Perhaps there's some guilt. And she convinces him that he really needs help more than she can provide for him. And somehow she gets him to agree to sign himself in to a facility back in the Netherlands where he's going to get some help. Anita was completely convinced her son was going. He was packed, his bags were ready. And when she came to his room, she found an empty bedroom. And his luggage was gone.
A note lies on Euron's bed.
But there was a note that Euron left for his mother, explaining that he had gone to Peru and that he was going to be participating in a poker tournament there. So essentially, the money that Euron has extorted from Beth Holloway ends up funding Stephanie Flores' murder.
Shoes pile under Euron's bed. Lima, Peru, 06-02-2010. In the hotel room. Items lie scattered on the floor.
They found my daughter at 5 a.m. It was terrible.
Crime scene photos flash.
The corpse presented traumatic lesions in the head and neck as a result of strangulation. She also had injuries on her face and her nose that were caused by blows, an external blow from someone else. The victim showed no signs of having defended herself. She suffered before she died.
A photo of Stephanie smiling and lying on a couch.
To batter somebody that brutally, you very likely would be in a state of true rage. Or you would be somebody who had a sadistic streak where you found it fun to cause people enormous amounts of suffering or pain.
They didn't let me see. I was told no. I wanted to remember my daughter as she was.
The police go through the surveillance tapes. What happens is Stephanie pulls up in her car. She's parked at such an angle, you know, right by the front door of the hotel. It's not a space you would park in if you were going to stay for a while. She walks in. She looks kind of angry. This was not a happy visit. This was not a tryst in a hotel room. It looked like they were going there to pick up something. The next thing you see is Joran pop out of the room. Sometime later, he goes to a local coffee shop. He picks up 2 cups of coffee, like he's bringing some coffee back to the room for his date. He's aware of the cameras, too. You know, he looks straight up at it. He was trying to establish an alibi. You know, why would I bring 2 cups of coffee if she was dead? And he goes back in the room, thinks about what to do, and ultimately just packs up his stuff, gets in her car, and just disappears. And he drives not far from the hotel, and he abandons the car. And it was a high crime area. He dropped the car off in a place that would maybe throw the police off the scent. And that bought him some time.
There's no panic, there's no fear. There's premeditation, there's methodical planning. He was very calm, cool, collected, made a plan. That takes a lot of meticulousness, and you only get that with experience.
Daytime. The white van rolls on an empty street.
When we got to the border, they checked his ID, his passport, his documents. It was all in order. I told him, this is as far as I go. There are banks over here. He told me, I don't have more money. And I asked him, so what now? He told me, I'll give you something. So he gave me a watch. He even asked for my phone number and said that he would call me one way or another to make a deposit later. That's why we were fine, and we even trusted him. He made us think he had money. He fooled us, to put it simply.
He's such an easy liar, and he seems to lie for fun. And after years, it became like a game to him. He really seemed to get off on having everybody hang on his every word and then be disappointed when they find out it's just a lie.
There's a thrill to the lie, and there's a thrill in knowing that you can make anyone believe anything is true. This is entertainment for him. The victims are inconsequential. The larger impacts to their family, society, doesn't matter.
Chile, 0603, 2010.
Well, it's a name we hope we never have to hear again, Joran Vandersloot.
Right now, police think Joran Vandersloot may be in Chile, where they're looking for him as their chief suspect in the murder of a young woman, a murder they think happened 5 years to the day after Joran Vandersloot was the last person to be seen with Natalie Holloway.
He's in another cab, passing through a toll booth.
you know, curled up on the floor of the back seat. The sharp-eyed person at a toll booth looks down. This is suspicious, and calls it in. And right there, it's over.
The alleged murderer of Stephanie Flores was located traveling by taxi, and Chilean agents arrested him there. That night at the wake, they informed us that he was already being sent to the Peruvian border.
A small plane takes off.
We knew this case was the twilight zone for so many reasons. It's staggering. Like, another girl on the anniversary, like on the exact same day?
At Stephanie's funeral and burial Thursday, her father got down on one knee for a farewell kiss to his beloved daughter.
The family walks together with the crowd.
Sort of felt like I had blood on my hands. I started the wheels in motion where he took the 25 grand, wanted to play in a poker tournament over in South America, and that's where he met Stephanie Flores. You know, I connected a lot of dots. It was a heavy burden.
Officers guide Yoron away from the plane.
It ended horribly wrong, you know, on all fronts.
His first statement to the Chilean police is he's been set up by corrupt Peruvian police officers. There were just a couple of rogue cops that were harassing him, following him, shaking him down for money. You know, these are the guys you should be looking at. It's always somebody else. It's one of his friends. It's his father. It's the cops. It's Yoron playing the victim.
He just seemed to have like two middle fingers up to the world. Maybe once you reach that point and you know that you did something so horrible and it finally caught up with you, maybe you just don't care anymore.
He wasn't talking his way out of this case. It was clear as day that he had murdered Stephanie Flores. He was out in the open now. We saw his true colors. We saw who he was.
Yoron's mugshot flashes. He walks through a prison.
Well, I'm the suspect in a homicide.
What was your motive?
I don't know.
He was probably adrift and wanted to tell the world, you think that I'm this terrible murderer? Okay, that's what I will be. I will do this again.
Lima, Peru, 06-06-2010.
He wanted a negotiation. He said, I'll confess, but you have to send me to Aruba. Confess, I tell him, and I'll send you. It was a promise we had to make him, an empty promise. Okay, I'll talk, he said. This is not an easy moment to... I tell him, I'm going to ask you a question. Did you kill Stephanie Tatiana? Yes. You killed Stephanie Tatiana Flores, right? Yes. And there he starts to confess his crime.
Yoron takes a drag.
She takes him to his hotel. According to him, he was supposedly going to show her how to play poker online.
An open laptop lies on a bed.
He shows her his laptop. He sees some messages and gets upset. Was it about the death of that girl in Aruba? Yes, that's right. Natalie. Yes. And Stephanie Flores asks him, why are you upset? Today is the date that they're accusing me of killing Natalie Holloway, and they're calling me a murderer. I was talking about it with her, and then she hit you? Yes. Where? On my head.
She had caught wind of who he was, and things escalated. I'm imagining she probably just wanted to get out of the room at that point. And, you know, the rest is, you know, just kind of a blur. He just went savage on her.
I reacted, and I hit her back. Did she start bleeding? Too much. She was bleeding a lot at that point. It was coming out of her nose, yes. And I just went for her neck. You grabbed her by the neck? Yes. You choked her neck? Yes. Ordinary murderers usually show remorse. They ask for forgiveness. But this murderer did not show any signs of regret. He is totally cold.
Regarding the defendant, Joran Andres Petrus van der Sloot, perpetrator of the crimes against the life, body, and health, and in aggravation of Stephanie Tatiana Flores Ramirez, he is sentenced to 28 years in prison.
He's convicted and sentenced to 28 years in prison. They don't convict people to life sentences like we would here. There's always room for rehabilitation, release, even for a murder like this.
Officers guide Joran with his hands behind his back.
We were seeking another sentence. But we accepted the judge's decision. He's going to pay the consequences. And that's reassuring.
His new address, a maximum security prison, home to Peru's most notorious killers, rapists, and terrorists.
We've taken measures to take care of him. We've made sure that nothing bad happens to him. Because if he dies, it's over. His suffering is over. His punishment is over. What he has to pay is over.
Initially, we thought Peruvian prison has to be horrifying. I mean, that was what we told ourselves. Like, there's no way he'll survive.
But he's like a chameleon. You know, he's able to adjust. It's a lot different than the American prison system. It's a little more porous. People can come in during the day, wives, girlfriends, vendors. And so that allows him access to the outside world.
It's not like he looks like he's flourishing in Peru by any means. But learning that he has had the opportunity to be married is mind-blowing to me. Somehow, he's been allowed to bring a child into this world.
A pregnant woman holds her belly, then a photo of Joran. Lima, Peru, 11, 2014. This woman fell in love with a murderer. She married him, and a month ago had his daughter. Her name is Lady, and she's the wife of the Dutchman, Joran van der Sloot. But that photo is from when he was much younger. Yes, his mom sent me that one. Aren't you afraid of him? No, not at all. I know him well. God has touched his heart. Officers walk with Joran.
That always happens, doesn't it? They see this attractive guy on TV and they get wrapped up in the danger or the like romance of, is he an innocent victim or who is he really? Or maybe it's, I can fix him.
When I first met Joran, he was lost in every way. I tried to mold him so that he would change.
It is disgusting that he's been able to have a wife. He can have pen pals. He can father a child.
I would like to take the opportunity to say hello to my family and tell them I love them very much.
Those were all things that Natalie Holloway was never able to do. It's a shame.
I would ask Joran, what would happen if God sent you a daughter and the same thing happens to your daughter? He would stay silent and say nothing. Officers help Joran out of a van. He fully regrets everything. You can't imagine his suffering. She seems to be a happy woman, but perhaps she's the only one who understands why. We will always be together, in the good times and in the bad times. We have a life ahead of us.
And this is for your daughter?
Yes. On a statue of a cat, Joran y Lady. Joran himself told me, I don't want to lie to you. I'm married, but I'm getting a divorce. Did you believe him? Honestly, yes. I believed him.
People who are psychopathic will often have multiple romantic partners at once. You do often see what's called sort of impersonal sexual behavior, so engaging in sexual relations that don't seem to be associated with any kind of a deep attachment. You see conning and manipulation because, again, you see other people as instruments to get what you want.
Ava stares off. I met Joran through a friend. This friend of mine had a boyfriend in that prison. The first thing I saw was that he had pretty eyes. I had no idea who he was. I thought he was serving a sentence for robbery or something like that. Joran asked what my favorite color was, what music I liked, what my dreams were. He has helped me a lot to love myself. To think that for someone else, I was a very important person. I had intimate encounters with Joran. They had that respect in the prison. They would turn to the wall. Joran's name is typed out in a search bar. One day I just happened to look up his name on the internet, and I found out everything he was being accused of. Photos of Natalie and Stephanie appear. My reaction was, what? How is this possible? Joran is not like that. He's always been a gentleman. I asked him and he avoided it. But he said, yes, the mistakes you make, you have to know to pay for them. I didn't ask again. Who was I to judge a person?
He knows what his targets want to hear, and that's all they are. They're targets, and ultimately, they're transactions. He's getting something out of them.
Ava holds the keychain. I helped Joran by buying things for him out here because he couldn't buy things for himself. One day, someone called me. He tells me, I want to send you an order on behalf of your partner. And I asked him, what is it? Rice, pasta, things like that. Groceries. It was just groceries. You just receive it. Don't worry, he said. Bye. Okay. When it was time to visit, I went that day. It was early morning. Each bag goes to be checked. They cut everything open. And in that moment, they split open the beets. Police said, arrest her. I was paralyzed. I couldn't say anything. Von der Sloot coordinated the entry of 297 grams of cocaine and 140 grams of marijuana that INPE agents found concealed. His current partner, Ava Pakawanako, tried smuggling the drugs to Ward No. 5, where Van der Sloot is imprisoned. A mugshot of Ava. Joran had hired some lawyers to help me. My lawyer helped me to get out of detention.
de detención.
There's an arrest warrant out for me today. The day they find me, I don't know what will become of me or my children. I regret having met him. Today, I feel that it wasn't love. I feel like it was more for protection. I would have wished with my soul that I had not met him. Ava wipes her nose and eye.
Even when he's in prison, he's not turning his life around and telling the truth and wanting to be a good new person. No, he's starting a cocaine trafficking ring inside of the prison. Why does he want to be so dark? I just don't understand why, for this human being with so much promise and intelligence and like a future and a path and a good family, why does he always choose the dark side?
Red lights flash outside a car.
Did you say goodbye to your family? No, they didn't let me say goodbye. Your daughter? Not even her?
In 2023, after more than a decade of negotiations between the United States and Peru, Joran van der Sloot was finally extradited to face federal charges for the extortion of Beth Holloway. Birmingham, Alabama, 06/09/2023.
Almost two decades after Natalie Holloway's haunting disappearance, the prime suspect in the case, Joran van der Sloot, touching down tonight in Birmingham, Alabama.
Joran van der Sloot always wanted to come to the United States. Well, here he is.
Van der Sloot was never charged in Holloway's disappearance, but he is accused of offering to tell Natalie's family how she died and where she was buried in exchange for $250,000.
The only negotiating tool that Joran van der Sloot has is the truth about what happened to Natalie Holloway. Once he gives that information up, he's worthless, he's meaningless. He has nothing left.
Today, Natalie's mother issuing a statement saying she's hopeful that some small semblance of justice may finally be realized.
The extradition of Joran van der Sloot back to the United States, something that Beth's been working on since Natalie disappeared. It's her second best shot. Her first best shot would be the recovery of her daughter's body. Her next best chance are these extortion charges.
Long time coming. All this time, every corner, twist, turn, it's like, here we are. 18 years later, my mom is standing in the courthouse within feet of the guy that killed my sister. We were all on the edge of our seats. I just wanted him to say that, yes, I killed Natalie.
Birmingham, Alabama, 10/18/2023.
How's the day feel?
Feels good. It's a nice day. It's a good day for judgment.
Are we going to get answers today?
Sam Brock, NBC News correspondent.
Joran van der Sloot has never been charged in the death of Natalie Holloway. However, the Holloway family attorney says that he is expected today, Savannah, to accept a plea deal related to wire fraud and extortion charges, assuming he tells federal authorities how Natalie Holloway died and the manner in which her body was disposed of.
People and cameramen gather outside the courthouse.
I feel like the whole world was in that courtroom with us. I mean, I could just feel it. It's like, here we are. This is the big moment where we're finally getting some semblance of justice for Natalie. I just wanted him to say that, yes, I killed Natalie. And that's what we got.
When Beth stood up and read her statement and read parts of what he had done, it felt like the wind had been knocked out of me. It was intense, and you could just like feel that energy. And I would say the most difficult part was how violent the description of her death was.
Yoron's Confession, October 2023.
Deepak drops me off at a place known as the Fisherman's Huts. I'm actually with Natalie walking along the beach. We lay down together in the sand, and we start kissing each other. And I start feeling her up again, and she tells me no. I insist, I keep feeling her up either way. She knees me in the crotch. And I kick her extremely hard in the face. She's laying down unconscious, possibly even dead, but definitely unconscious. And right next to her, there's a huge cinder block laying on the beach. I take this and I smash her head in with it completely. Her face basically, collapses in. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. So I grab her and I push her off. Into the sea.
Nighttime. Waves roll onto a shore. Outside the courthouse, Beth walks with others down steps. Cameramen look through their cameras. Beth and others approach microphones.
Today, I can tell you with certainty that after 18 years, Natalie's case is solved. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. It's over. Yoron Vandersloot is no longer the suspect in my daughter's murder. He is the killer. That was all verified by a comprehensive and conclusive polygraph test. We finally, today, we got justice for Natalie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
All right, I like the show.
Beth Holloway was satisfied for so many years. She's gotten all these different stories, but listening to her, you got the sense that she believed what he said about the fate of her daughter.
Hearing him in my hometown saying he was Natalie's killer, I'm really trying to lean into the acceptance of that's our level of closure. But a sociopath will gain pleasure from someone else's pain. So it doesn't surprise me that his story was incredibly gruesome and specific.
One thing that psychopaths can do is they can add details and embellishments to trigger an emotion from people. I think the cinder block idea isn't true necessarily, because that would be evidence you could find. You'd find a missing cinder block if you tried to get rid of it somewhere.
I think there will always be lingering questions, and people will have their doubts about Yoron's confession. Anything released along those beaches would end up being pulled back into shore, no matter what. That's the way the current runs. We just have slowly drifted right back onto the sand and gone nowhere. That's not what happened. That's not how she was disposed of. I'm convinced of that.
It just feels like common sense that there had to have been some type of extra outside help to ultimately make sure that this Natalie goes away and is never found. And that's where I believe his dad played the part.
The judge sentenced Vandersloot to 20 years behind bars to run concurrently with the sentence that he is already serving right now in Peru.
When he finishes his murder sentence for Stephanie Flores, he'll just be a free man unless he gets out early. Then he would have to come to the United States and serve jail.
Officers walk Yoron through a prison.
The concurrent sentence that Yoron was given, he'd be getting out at 57 years old. He's going to have a full life ahead of him still. He might even have grandchildren. But Beth went along. She wanted the answers.
On a film set, Beth sits.
Hey, camera Mark.
The way the murder was described, Natalie never knew what happened. hit her was immediate and painless for her, the way it sounded. So maybe there's comfort in that.
John nods.
You said something to me that really struck me. You said that this is better than closure.
It is.
Why is this better than closure?
You know, for me, closure is not what I got. I got it's over. It's solved. Jeroen van der Sloot is the murderer. The not knowing is more torturous than the knowing. The not knowing is the never-ending nightmare, and that's worse.
But now you do know. And the knowing is horrific in terms of the details of what he did.
It is. It is. It is. And it's shocking to us to think that somebody is capable of doing that.
Do you think 20 years is enough time?
I don't think any victim's family is going to think ever an amount of time is enough. So here's what I have to take comfort in is what I needed. And I needed the answers as to what happened to Natalie. So I feel like now I can kind of like, oh, now I can focus on that. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you properly buckled, Hootie?
Natalie reaches for her seatbelt.
You're not. Got that you're caught.
When you look at the collateral damage on the Holloway family, his family, the island of Aruba, the Flores family, it's unbelievable that one individual can create such chaos and havoc.
Ricardo stares out a window.
We were a normal family. A happy family. We were close. And this destroyed us. It destroyed the family. He took away who we loved most, the only daughter we had. It's a wound that will never heal.
All I can think about is where Natalie would have fit in. We've all been bridesmaids in everybody's wedding. We all take our kids to the same parks that we grew up going to, and she was senselessly never given that opportunity. It would have been her with us. And also, I wonder what kind of doctor she would have been, so I could call and be like, my kid's ear hurts, you know, what do I do? I mean, she was a dependable, amazing human.
Claire nods.
I really wish, now that I'm older, I could go back and get to know who she was those last few months, because that's, man, you know, I'll never get that back. And I don't want people to ever forget this. I hope he's miserable. It's what he deserves. I definitely want to talk to him. And I definitely want to whoop his ass. Which one's going to come first? I don't know. I know there's more to the story, and there always will be. And we got to keep digging. Otherwise, it's all in vain. I owe it to my family and to Natalie. I'm not going to stop.
Audio description written by Olivia Habib. Narrated by Nicole Cyril and Tristan Snyder. Credits appear. Producer, Eleanor West. Editors, Barry Blaschke, ACE. Eric Laspi, Carlos Stanley Aguilera. Director of Photography, Tim Metzger. Post-production supervisor, Alex Pilkington. Post-production coordinator, Jake Vest. Supervising post-producer, Shelby Kilgore. Post-production services, Blue Table Post. NBC News Studios, Peacock. Copyright 2024 Peacock Media Productions, LLC. And NBC Universal Media, LLC. All rights reserved.